headlines. The UN chief warns of an economic collapse in Afghanistan, calling on the international community to provide humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. Palestinian groups and factions declare Friday a day of rage to protest against Israel's decision to relocate inmates following a jailbreak this week. And Chinese President Xi Jinping says U.S. policies towards Beijing have caused serious difficulties in the relationship between the two countries. Thank you for joining us. UN has warned of an economic collapse in Afghanistan and called on the international community to maintain a dialogue with the Taliban.
Naturally, the Taliban want to be recognized. They want the sanctions to be lifted. They want financial support, and this gives the international community some leverage. I think that naturally we don't have an internationally recognized government yet, but I also think that we have to avoid an economic collapse situation which could create appalling humanitarian consequences for the Afghan people.
Guterres added millions of Afghans could die if an economic collapse happens in their country. The UN chief urged the international community to provide humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. He said Afghanistan must be governed in peace and stability, and the rights of all people must be respected. Guterres also said the United Nations wants an inclusive government in that country. On Tuesday, the Taliban announced an interim all-male government. They did so 3 weeks after they seized power in Afghanistan following sweeping territorial gains. Alireza Khomeili is a researcher on Islamic groups and lives in the Afghan capital. Earlier, he joined us from Kabul and explained how things have changed under the Taliban rule.
I'm now in Kabul. I see the situation, economical situation is not good. I don't know is it collapsed or not, but I know that a huge amount of the budgets or income of Afghanistan was from the outside, so the funding of Afghanistan should be continued. The situation in the bazaar is not good. Some of the people are displaced. But I think the situation now is normal because the security is everywhere. And maybe it will be better. But the funds of the foreigners should be continued because till now, the new government couldn't catch the new incomes for Afghanistan. So the previous incomes should be continued for the Afghans.
Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations called for the formation of a truly inclusive government in Afghanistan that has emerged from a free and fair election.
Indeed, the path to a stability, durable peace and sustainable development in Afghanistan passes through intra-Afghan talks, with the active and equal participation of the true representatives of all ethnic, linguistic, and religious groups aimed at finding a just, peaceful, and durable solution to the crisis, achieving national reconciliation, and establishing a truly inclusive, broad-based, and fully representative government that has emerged from a free and fair elections, including with the full participation of women both as voters and candidates.
Addressing a Security Council meeting, Majid Takhravanchi expressed concerns over the presence of terrorist groups in Afghanistan. He said terrorists, like Daesh, must not be allowed to operate in the country. The Iranian diplomat also condemned a recent attack by the Taliban on Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley, where there was a resistance against the group. Takhravanchi described the attack as unjustifiable and condemnable. He stressed that Afghanistan's dire situation, where millions need humanitarian assistance to live by, is the direct result of the 20-year U.S. war in the country. He noted that war crimes by foreign forces in Afghanistan must not go unpunished. Political commentator Jason Andruha says Western powers can't punish the Afghan people just because they don't like the Taliban.
You know, just because the Western powers don't actually like the Taliban or the way the Taliban does business or the fact that they lost the war to the Taliban, this is absolutely no reason to punish the people of Afghanistan. In fact, it would be a very heartless measure to simply cut off aid to the poor simply because you don't like who the government is. I mean, this is what we're supposed to believe, that the whole point of going to war in Afghanistan was to, you know, fight terrorism and liberate the Afghani people. Well, there's nothing very liberating about going hungry or not having any medical treatment available for anyone who needs it. In fact, withholding these would definitely show the true intention of the United States, and that it was only intended to control the country, and many of the other Western powers as well, such as the UK, that their only real intention was to gain control of the country.
Palestinian groups and factions have declared Friday a day of rage to protest against Israel's decision to relocate inmates following a jailbreak this week. In a statement, the resistance movement Hamas called on the Palestinian people to voice their anger at the Israeli occupation and its aggression against prisoners. In the meantime, a Palestinian Authority official warned that Israel's code of repressive practices could spark a new uprising. On Monday, six Palestinian inmates broke out of a heavily guarded Israeli prison. The regime has launched a manhunt for the inmates. Palestinians have warned Israel of major unrest if any of the six prisoners is killed. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held several rallies to condemn Israel's new violent measures against Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails following the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Gilboa prison. Ruba Shabbat reports from Gaza.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbu prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jilbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army.
Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Chinese President Xi Jinping says U.S. policies towards Beijing have caused, quote, serious difficulties in their bilateral ties. Xi made the comment in a phone call with his American counterpart, Joe Biden. The Chinese president called for putting ties back on track. He said that's critical for the future and the destiny of the world. Biden made it clear that Washington welcomes competition, but does not want it to lead to conflict. That's according to a senior official of his administration. The official said the goal of the phone conversation was to set out, quote, guardrails to ensure that relations can be managed responsibly. Ties have secured between China and the U.S. in the past several years over a number of issues, including trade and security. A U.S. media poll says many Americans believe that events after September 11, 2001 had a more negative than a positive impact on the country. According to the survey conducted by Washington Post and ABC News, 46% of the people say the events of 9/11 changed the country for the worse, while 33% believe they changed the country for the better. That represents a large swing from the first anniversary of the attacks in 2002. Back then, 55% said the country had changed for the better. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on 9/11 when hijacked airplanes smashed into the World Trade Center towers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. Political analyst Dion Williams says the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks was disproportionate.
The reaction in Afghanistan was completely disproportionate. The small group of people who conducted these raids were, as you pointed out, more closely related to the Saudis than to the Afghans. And when the army did go in there, into Afghanistan, which allegedly was the cause and the root of the terrorists, they didn't go with huge armies. They used mercenaries. They used warlords. They used people. Well, they were used war criminals, basically. And they were paid for from CIA funds to get rid of the Taliban, while the main military force and money was spent in Iraq, which was completely unrelated. I mean, what could go wrong by hitting the wrong target with the wrong forces while, you know, and ignoring the real target?
The U.S. surveillance of its citizens is a known fact, but what is not known is the extent of the surveillance, which some have called spying. A new poll has found that Americans are not keen on their government spying on them, but the way the U.S. government goes about spying and how it uses its surveillance data against the ones it targets, that is what's controversial.
A recent poll has found that more Americans were against the government's intrusive surveillance programs. The poll was conducted by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research and interviewed over 1,700 American adults in mid-August. According to the poll, 46% of Americans say that they oppose the U.S. government responding to threats against the nation by reading emails sent between people outside of the U.S. without a warrant. That's compared to just 27% who are in favor. In an AP-NORC poll conducted one decade ago, 47% favored the practice, but only 30% of Americans opposed the move. The poll found bipartisan concerns about the scope of surveillance and the expansive intelligence collection tools that U.S. authorities have at their disposal. The poll also says that 44% of Americans are also more likely to oppose government eavesdropping on calls outside of the U.S. without a warrant. Only 28% of Americans favor the practice.
Well, I think the big problem today has been less surveillance and other kinds of censorship of social media. I mean, that's turned out to be much more important, I think. I mean, the government and private agencies, private companies are actively censoring the social media of all sorts and seriously affecting what the information that that ordinary Americans are able to access.
Most Americans taking part in the poll, about 6 in 10, said the long U.S. wars fought in Afghanistan and Iraq were not worth fighting. According to the poll, about two-thirds of Americans say that they were extremely or very worried about the threat posed by homegrown extremist groups.
The U.S. spying program increased vastly after the 9/11 attacks, but the scope of this spying was not realized until the revelations of former NSA contractor and whistleblower Edward Snowden. One example, he revealed that 9 internet firms spied on Americans, including Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo. That included emails, search engines, and you name it, the full scope of how the internet was used. Australia's new daily COVID infections have surged past 1,900. That marks the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. New South Wales reported over 1,500 of the new cases. The southeastern state is the epicenter of the current outbreak in Australia. That's the worst outbreak there. It began in mid-July and has been fueled by the highly infectious Delta variant. The rest of the new daily cases were logged in Victoria state. Both Victoria and New South Wales have been under lockdown for weeks now to curb the virus spread. Authorities are now planning to ease some restrictions over the next few weeks as they are getting close to their target of inoculating residents. And that does it for this edition of World News.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of our weekly series, Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we are in the process of explaining Surah Hujurat, which is the 49th in the serial order of compilation of the Holy Quran. We continue from where we left off last week, and here is Ayah 10 of Surah Hujurat.
إنما المؤمنون إخوة فأصلحوا بين أخويكم واتقوا الله لعلكم ترحمون.
The faithful are indeed brothers. Therefore make peace between your brothers and be wary of Allah, so that you may receive His mercy. If you might recall last Friday in our explanation of the previous ayah of this surah, we pointed out that sometimes clashes occur among individuals or groups of society, and in such cases it is but natural for each party to seek help from its friends. The Holy Quran stresses that fellow Muslims ought not to be mere onlookers in such cases, but should mediate peace between the conflicting groups. We also said that everyone is responsible towards peace, stability and security of society. Hence, they cannot be indifferent and should strive to remove friction. The ayah, which we just recited to you, now establishes the bond of brotherhood among the true believers as among the honors of Islam. It treats the relationship amongst believers like that between brothers, since friendship between two brothers is deeply rooted and firm. It is bilateral rather than unilateral, and is based on innate nature and disposition rather than on worldly and mundane appeals. Islam advises Muslims to stand above all superficial differences such as ethnic, racial, linguistic, geographical, or color of skin, so that nobody would consider themselves superior to others. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, established the bond of brotherhood among his companions. He used to emphasize, "There is no superiority for Arabs over non-Arabs, or for the white over the black, and all are brothers and creatures of God." Thus, according to this ayah, all true believers are like brethren, and all contentions and conflicts amongst brethren ought to be replaced by peace and sincerity. This is humanism in the best sense of the word, since Muslim brotherhood is the greatest social ideal known to society. This ayah teaches us, 1. In Islam, all believers are equal without any superiority over others. And 2, it is incumbent to make peace between brothers by removing differences. And 3, peace leads to harmony and results in divine mercy. Now Now let us listen to Ayah 11 of Surah Hujurat.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا يسخر قوم من قوم عسى أن يكونوا خيرا منهم ولا نساء من نساء ولا نساء من نساء عسى أن يكن خيرا منهن ولا تلمزوا أنفسكم ولا تنابزوا بالألقاب بئس الاسم الفسوق بعد الإيمان ومن لم يتب فأولئك هم الظالمون.
O you who have faith, let not any people ridicule another people. It may be that they are better than they are. Nor let women ridicule women. It may be that they are better than they are. And do not defame one another, nor insult one another by calling nicknames. How evil are profane names subsequent to faith. And whoever is not penitent, such are the wrongdoers. This ayah is continuation of the previous one and stresses that no man or woman is allowed to mock others. Moreover, no one should call others by improper names or nicknames. It is a sin for such a person not to repent, and whoever is not a penitent is a wrongdoer. It is important to note that mutual ridicule ceases to be fun when there is arrogance or selfishness or malice or contempt behind it. We may laugh with people, but we must never laugh at people to disgrace or dishonor them. Defamation may consist in speaking ill of others by the spoken or written word, or in acting in such a way as to hurl a negative charge. A biting remark or taunt or sarcasm is included in the Arabic word lamaza, as used by the Holy Quran. An offensive nickname may amount to defamation. This ayah teaches us the following points. 1. Faith in God does not comply with ridiculing others. 2. Ridiculing other individuals or ethnicities is a sign of superciliousness. The Holy Quran has strongly opposed this habit, saying the ones who are ridiculed may be better than those who ridicule. And 3, among the strategic goals of Islam is to build a sound and healthy society devoid of evil behaviors. Now let us listen to Ayah 12 of Surah Hujurat as the concluding ayah of this week's program.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا اجتنبوا كثيرا من الظن إن بعض الظن إثم ولا تجسسوا ولا يغتب بعضكم بعضا أيحب أحدكم أن يأكل لحم أخيه ميتا فكرهتموه واتقوا الله إن الله تواب رحيم.
O you who have faith, avoid much suspicion. Indeed, some suspicions are sins. And do not spy or backbite one another. Will any of you eat the flesh of his dead brother? You would hate it. And be wary of Allah. Indeed, Allah is all clement, all merciful. This ayah mentions three causes of undermining brotherhood in society. Unfortunately, some people are suspicious of others. This makes them spy on others and may also make them backbite. Backbiting means saying something about somebody that will upset him or her if she or he hears it. This ayah likens backbiting to eating the flesh of one's dead brother. Thus, most kinds of suspicion are baseless, and some are crimes in themselves. Therefore, conjecture, or qiyas, has been outlawed in Islam. Spying into other people's affairs means either idle curiosity or suspicion carried a stage further. Backbiting is mischievous, and if poisoned with malice, it is a sin added to sin. It is like eating the flesh of a dead brother, which is abomination plus abomination. The Holy Prophet has remarked, backbiting is worse than adultery because Allah may forgive an adulterer or adulteress if he or she turns repentant to him. But pardon for backbiting is not available until the aggrieved person agrees to forgive. From this ayah we learn that 1. In an Islamic society, people live on the basis of goodwill and trust one another. 2. Suspicion sets the ground for spying and eventually backbiting. And 3. Some of the sins are so grave that the Holy Quran points to their inward reality. Backbiting is one such sin. It is like eating the flesh of one's dead brother, because a dead person cannot defend against defaming and losing face. And 4. There is no dead end in Islam. Penitence can remove all sins, as God is all-merciful and accepts repentance.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States is anything but united these days. Inside the country lies much discontent and a major divide. And outside the country, even Washington's allies are starting to say that the U.S. hegemony is waning rapidly, especially after the Afghanistan debacle. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the American empire? Or are we rapidly approaching its dissolution? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport, where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower. But a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant.
the United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Matnia out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Ian in New York. Ian, do you think that the U.S. is waning? And if so, when do you think this actually started? Some say from 1971 when gold no longer backed the dollar. Others say since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what's your assessment of this overall?
It's very difficult to say. Oh, it's been waning almost the minute it was established, because people successfully stood against it. You could say that the Vietnamese victory against the U.S. was a clear signal, but it was definitely at its height after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and with the Iraq War. The U.S. was unchallenged internationally. Even its enemies didn't really dare go against it. That's been eroded totally. But what happened in Afghanistan was not significant in economic or military terms. It was significant in terms of prestige, which, as far as global diplomacy is concerned, is almost as important. But people are still going to think twice before they challenge the U.S. They still have hugely disproportionate armed forces. They still have hugely disproportionate financial support. Less so than it was, and it's definitely waning, and a lot less quickly than some of us would have hoped, perhaps. But it's also got rising, it's got rising rivals, in particular China. I don't really think that Russia is one of the major rivals. It's Russia is sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons. It doesn't have a massive economy, but it does have this residual armed forces and nuclear weapons. China is a rising power in every sense, and obviously the U.S. is scared about it. But once again, the U.S. isn't unrivaled there, and China can't really exploit the U.S.'s weakness, because one of the reasons why China has been rising is because it sells so much of its goods to the United States, and it borrows so much money from the United States, it lends so much money to the United States. So they're inextricably bound together. It's not a straight one-on-one superpower confrontation like Moscow and Washington in what you might say the bad old days, when they really didn't have that much to do with each other. There was almost minimal contact in culturally, financially, and other ways. But the United States is a victim of its own failures.
Stay with me. Let me. We're going to talk about the reasons for this, but let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Now, American political scientist Francis Fukuyama says that the truth of the matter is that the end of the American era had come much earlier. The long-term sources of American weakness and decline are more domestic than international. What do you think about that?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I think the decline of the U.S. forces started not when the U.S. was engaged in war, like in Lebanon 1982 or 1983, in Iraq in 2003, in Syria 2011. It is, what is the outcome of all these wars? Of course, the U.S. has the strongest military machine and military power, but what is the result of this machine? It winning the ground and then not be able to hold it? It's exactly the same as ISIS is able today to attack small villages and win and then withdraw. But the U.S. is able to stay for much longer, for many years, and then being kicked out and forced to withdraw. The moment the Americans sit with the Taliban and negotiate a peace deal is the moment of the decline and the defeat of the U.S. after 20 years. So there is no point for the U.S. to have so much the mighty military power when the result is very slim at the end of the day. So yes, it is a decline of the empire. It is the rising of other forces that not only are rival, but also are defying the U.S. and challenging the U.S. Forces, even if they don't stand to the exact U.S. Military power, and they have a minor force. But however, they can and they are able to defy the U.S., like we've seen that in Iran, we've seen that in Syria, we've seen that in Lebanon, and we've seen that in Iraq, even a small group. And the Taliban managed to stand against the Americans and force the withdrawal. So yes, I think the U.S. Defense Secretary is quite right by saying it is just a big power, but it's big power not able to reach the end, achieve anything at the end of the day.
Okay, well, Ian, there have always been different opinions in the U.S., like most places, but it was magnified greatly during the Trump era. How divided do you actually think the country is currently?
It's extremely divided. And I just want to add that the people who brought you the Iraq War were the people behind the project for the new American century. And they foresaw this precisely. In their own way, they were clear-sighted. They said America was declining economically, and so they had to cement in a military advantage now to ensure their hegemony over the next few years. And they're proved entirely right, apart from the fact of being hopelessly optimistic. And what we're seeing now is there's always been a problem with American foreign policy. It's never been, it's never been joined up. It's a result of different lobbies of forces within there. It's almost Byzantine in the way that the State Department, the Pentagon, the military industrial contractors, the politicians representing the lobbies, where they kick things around until it comes. And then, in the past, you had the State Department acting like a gyroscope and saying, well, yes, you might want that, but international law says no. Jerusalem is not Israel's capital. Or international law says no, Western Sahara is not part of Morocco, no matter what the President of the United States says. But that type of moderating influence is almost gone, because one of the things that Trump and the ideologues did was to wage a complete war against the State Department and the more rational aspects of the American foreign policy establishment. So in that sense, what Joe Biden has done is entirely rational. He said we can't win in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not one of our essential, it's not one of our essential fields of operation for the United States. The United States interests are not inextricably bound up there. Prestige might be, but we can live with their prestige. We're still the biggest military in the world. And then, the old story about sticks and stones may break my bones, but the names will not be okay. I'm not the big superpower. Try anything on me and see what I do. It's a rational position that Biden's taken. But it is symbolic of American decline and the decline of their decision-making apparatus that universally the political, military, and intelligence people let Biden down so thoroughly that he did not know that the Taliban had basically entered into an agreement and they bought the Afghan army wholesale on the ground, unit by unit.
You talked about that it's the logical thing to do, the rational thing to do. I think probably the question, though, for the American people and much of the world would be the way that they did what they did and why that they leave in the way that they did and cause such chaos. And what does that do to the American psyche itself? Because the American people, first of all, don't like to believe that they've been beaten, that they've lost the war, number one. And second of all, they don't like to hear that some have been left behind and basically American troops are running out of Afghanistan. I mean, what has that done in general for the American psyche inside of the country?
The American psyche, as far as I can see, is completely unflappable. Really, they really don't care. Afghanistan is a faraway country with a strange-sounding name, and most Americans are just happy to get out of there. Some of them might see it as a blot on their escutcheon, but, you know, another way of looking at it, if you're being rational, bearing in mind that it was a completely unprecedented collapse, that was the real failure, the fact that that wasn't anticipated. The U.S. showed its power. It got out over 100,000 people in a very short time from allegedly a hostile territory with very few casualties and very few left behind. It's shameful, but actually that shame is mostly brought on by the Trump people who brought about the debacle to begin with, who are picking on Biden for partisan points. I'm not a fan of Biden, but this was one of the more rational things, and a lot of what he's been accused of goes squarely back to Donald Trump and the Republicans who started this thing. Now, okay. Biden was one of the cheerleaders for those foreign adventures as part of the sort of neocon conspiracy to defend Israel, but on this particular aspect, He was clear-sighted. Couldn't win enough. We have to get out.
Elijah, your assessment of it all, and what do you see as the main causes of the U.S.'s deterioration?
I think there are many points here. It is not only the rush that the U.S. left Afghanistan. It is only also the behavior toward the allies. I mean, here, Europe is under shock to see how the U.S. withdrew without even consulting Europe, and the way they withdrew without talking to the allies. And this is why we're here today to talk about the necessity to form a European army, which is very early, and I don't know where this is going to lead us. However, the reason why the U.S. felt in such a hurry to leave is because they had a wrong information, a wrong assessment of the army that they have trained, and they had a very high expectation.
How does that happen? Sorry to jump in here, Elijah. I mean, how does that happen? You say wrong assessment. 20 years on the ground, 20 years American troops working or being side by side with Afghan troops, obviously evaluating the situation. How do you get it so wrong after 20 years?
Because the Americans make mistakes after mistakes, this is not the first time. And because they lack also the understanding of the culture, they made this mistake in Iraq severely, and they did it again in Afghanistan when they expected to see the Afghan army engage in a civil war against other Afghani while they are negotiating with them in Qatar and delivering the country back to the Taliban. And they expect the army to fight and give them just 6 months' time so they can pull out all the Americans and the Afghan collaborators. And they say, done, we are out, and now you can continue fighting until you kill each other, and Taliban will again overwhelm all the army that we've trained for 20 years. This is a real failure that we've seen also in Iraq in 2014, where they've trained the army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army crumbled in just 3 days in Mosul and in the north of Iraq. It is not only the failure of the intelligence services, It is not the lack of visibility and right assessment. It is not only the non-understanding of the state and the local culture. It is just everything was going wrong. And because they think, well, the American think, we can import our culture anywhere we go, this is fundamentally wrong. They are never going to change the culture of a country, and is never going to be customized to the Americans' culture and mentality. Nobody asked the Americans to come, and nobody asked, and they were forced to leave. After 20 years, they removed the Taliban in 2001 to give back the power in 2021 again to the Taliban.
Ian, even during a pandemic and health crisis, we have seen anything but solidarity in the way the American society has approached the issue. I mean, do you attribute this to a major mistrust by many of their leadership overall? And how does this affect the whole, the schism that has come about inside of the country? Is there overall mistrust for the leadership?
Well, I mean, you quoted at the beginning Francis Fukuyama, who wrote just before the end of the Cold War about the after the end of the Cold War about the end of history, when in fact history had just restarted where it was left off in 1914. And to give him his due, Francis Fukuyama has admitted he was wrong about that thesis. And here, in effect, we're seeing the American Civil War still continuing after 160 years. I mean, the issues of race and privilege and culture are still hugely predominant here. I mean, we have Texas just passed an act which basically encourages vigilantism against women. We have almost post-Reconstruction states legislatures all over the South enacting legislation that makes it almost impossible for minorities and poor people to vote. And this is being done without interference on the federal level. We have a party which tried to stage a coup against its own government on January the 6th. We have a failed president who's proclaiming he's still won. These are not the hallmarks of a sophisticated and balanced society. This is a society that's riven down the middle, and there are people who hate each other. You know, 30-40% of Americans don't believe you can be patriotic and a Democrat. They certainly don't believe you can be patriotic and a socialist. They have their own very peculiar definitions, and it's a society that's based on exclusion and hatred on their part. They're actually dying in thousands because they think that wearing masks is a form of subservience to socialism, to galloping communism. They're refusing vaccinations in the middle of a death-dealing plague. I mean, you know, it's difficult. The German word is Schadenfreude, to take pleasure at the misfortunes and others. But I can't help grinning every time I see the latest right-wing radio commentator dying of COVID after he's run his latest rampage about vaccination and masks. They're still dying, though. Until they hit the hospital bed and the tubes are rammed down their throats, what's coming the other way out of their throats are invocations to resist the government, resist masks, watch out for those Democrats, they're coming after your daughters and everything else. It really is a very sick society, and there's it goes back to the Civil War, but it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who saw those fissures were still there and started the process of enlarging the fissures, of basically playing the race card, which they've done year after year, and now it's an even bigger, it's a culture card, where, you know, any minorities are the target for vilification and witch hunts. It's not a stable society. And what's worse is that the people who actually make the decisions in Washington, the last 20 years of hollowing out by the Republicans, they've taken away. For years, if you spoke Arabic in the State Department, you were denied promotion. And you were talking about how could they? When the Shah was driven out of Tehran, U.S. mission people were still sending back rosy reports because none of them read Farsi. They didn't see all the graffiti on the street walls saying death to the Shah on their way in. They probably thought it was an advert for Coca-Cola. They did not know what was happening in the country they were stationed in because of their cultural arrogance.
Well, what about that, Elijah? I mean, now when we look at the situation, and the overall situation of the U.S. Many will say that it's a dying empire. It's under lots of pressure right now as far as its so-called prestige in the world. Other analysts will say it's some of the most dangerous times when an empire feel pressured. Your take on where this can go with the United States basically waning, as Ian said at the beginning, it may be waning, but it still has a lot of power. Your assessment of it at this point in time?
I think we are in a very dangerous situation today. The danger comes from an administration that wants to show that it has not been defeated and it still had the power to do something. And that will take us to the possibility of American just supporting another war somewhere or a battle between in West Asia. Secondly, the Americans, if they are smart enough to understand that they cannot sustain a presence in country where there is no interest to stay, like, for example, in northeast Syria, that is even exactly the same as Afghanistan, is so far, there is no interest for the Americans to stay there. It's staying in Iraq when the population, half of the population at least, is against them and carrying attack. So if they reach this realization that it is time to stop being involved in country that are far, there is no interest for the American, and they have to withdraw, then the world will be really in a better shape.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see really an American administration committing one mistake after another.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on the Spotlight. Senior analyst, foreign policy and focus, Ian Williams out of New York, and journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Last Savior. I